Well, good morning, everybody. That was pretty good. It's fine spring day, right? Whose car doors were frozen shut? Who made their wife go out there and open them anyway, Phil? Yeah, all right, good man. All right. Hey, welcome again to Faith. My name is Mike. I am one of the pastors on staff here. It's good to have you here with us. Thanks for braving the elements and coming out on a Sunday. Just as we get started this morning, just want to take a minute and pray. We have the privilege of being able to come to God and thank Him and ask for His help, and we just want to do that. So let's take a minute and pray together, and then we'll dive into things. Father, thank You that we are here, that we get to be here, that we get to do this, just for the good things that You are doing here in this church. And God, just grateful just for all the people who come together and work in so many different ways to make this possible. The people we see and the people who are behind the scenes doing that. I just thank You for the ways that we get to partner in ministry with so many others. Just this morning, I was reading about Greg and Mary Ellen Schrock, and just the work that they are doing with Wycliffe and the ministry there in Mexico. Father, just thank You that we get to partner with them. Pray that You would bless the work that they are doing administratively. They are behind the scenes making so much happen with finances and with leadership in the school, and the ministry of Bible translation just wouldn't be taking place without the support that they're given. Father, just as I've talked to people this week, there are so many people here in our church who are just struggling just with things with their health, in relationships, and in finances. I just pray that You would meet them in that, that we'd love each other well in that. And Father, just we want to think beyond our own world, just our own church. And there's just so many needs across the globe. It can be overwhelming. But God, we just pray for Venezuela and just all the unrest and instability that is there right now, just the panic that that is creating, that You would move there, that You would just bring stability in the government and in the economy. Help us, please, as we just consider the words of Jesus this morning. In His name we pray. Amen. So we are kind of right smack dab in the middle of a series that we've entitled What Love Does. And if you haven't been here with us, real quick, this is a series that we have built on a statement that Jesus made, a statement Jesus made about His followers and to His followers. It's a statement that Jesus made, and in this statement, Jesus tells His followers that He's calling them to something new, that He's calling them to something that should set them apart from the culture that surrounds them, that should distinguish them from every other faith and creed, something that should serve as a primary identifier of who they are, something that should cause the culture that surrounds them, though that culture might be critical of what they believe, to be envious of what they have. Now, the statement is one that we've been looking at all series long. It's recorded for us in the book of John. And in it, Jesus simply says this. He says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." See, according to Jesus, this new thing, this identifying thing, this compelling thing that He's called His followers to is simply love. It's the way they're going to love each other. And so over the course of the series, we've been exploring together what this kind of love looks like. And we've seen that this kind of love is refreshing. It's refreshing compared to some of the self-love that's so prevalent in our world today. It's hard to find people that are going to love others. It's easy to find folks we're going to love themselves. We almost seem to excel at self-love in our culture today. In fact, as I was doing research for this message, I came across kind of a fun example of self-love. Anybody ever hear of Nadine Swigert? You're about to, all right? So Nadine did, in 2017, at the age of 36, Nadine did something a little bit unusual. She got married. Now, getting married wasn't the unusual thing. It's who Nadine was married to. That's right. Nadine married herself. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was a Vegas ceremony. I mean, so anything can go in Vegas, right? She walked down the aisle. There was a giving away of the bride. She exchanged vows with herself. She exchanged rings with her inner groom. When it was time for the kiss, to kiss the bride, she had the whole congregation blow kisses to the world, right? In a complete ceremony, Nadine married herself. And when folks asked her, like, why in the world would you do this? Her explanation was really quite simple. My whole life, nobody's loved me the way I deserve to be loved. And if it was going to happen right, I was just going to have to do it myself. It's what she did. And so she had this ceremony. It was the best way she could think of to let her whole world know what she was doing. She invited all her family and friends to witness this and to celebrate it with her and to hold her accountable to it. If you were to get a hold of Nadine today, she reports that she's doing well in this relationship. She takes herself out on regular romantic dates so as to invest in the thing, right? It's weird, it's kind of crazy, it's kind of fun. But in our world today, people are proficient at self-love. But to find individuals or to find a community of people where they're proficient at loving others rather than themselves, that's something different today. And it's something that people today, they're just hungry for. They're just hungry for it. And according to Jesus, that's who we're supposed to be. That should mark us. It should be the primary identifier of who we are. And so in this series, we've been asking ourselves, okay, if that's the case, then what does that kind of love look like? Specifically, what would we need to do to love each other in such a way that everyone would know we're following Jesus? What does love do? And so in each week, we've just looked at a different facet of what love does. Because again, love is multifaceted. It is complex. You're not going to get it all figured out in one conversation. So each week, we've looked at a different thing that love does, and we're going to continue to do that this weekend. This weekend, in order to discover what else love does, we're going to turn to the words of the Apostle John. John was an eyewitness of Jesus, one of Jesus' first followers. John's the guy who records this statement for us. And John had the privilege of kind of living through the early church, got to be part of that, got to see how that first church lived into what Jesus said here well, got to see times where that first church lived into what Jesus said here poorly. And so towards the end of his life, John took the time to write down for us what love really looks like, what love does. Here's what John said. He said, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother or sister in need and has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." So what John does is here is he just begins to talk about what love does. And he does so in a couple of ways. He starts off kind of grand, kind of ultimate, kind of cerebral, kind of very theological. And then he shifts gears and he gets super practical, super nuts and bolts, super applicable to our lives. And so we're just going to walk through this today, just kind of pick it apart and see what we can learn about what love does. So again, as John starts, he says, "Hey, you want to know what love is? You want me to show you?" Any children of the 80s, Foreigner fans? No? Okay, forget it. John's like, "Look, you want to know what love is?
Look at you. Thank you, Phil. All right, somebody, all right? He says, look at Jesus. You don't even look at, Jesus gives us the ultimate example of love in that he laid down his life for us. John says, you want to see love? Look at Jesus. Jesus illustrates love in laying down his life for us. Now, this kind of love John is talking about here, it is a distinct kind of love. Jonathan Edwards, theologian Jonathan Edwards, makes a distinction between two kinds of love, complacent love and benevolent love. Complacent love is when I love something because of the enjoyment or the life that I get out of that thing, the benefit I receive from it. You know, so we'll say things like, you know, I love tacos, right? Or I love warm weather vacation destinations. I love March Madness, right? You know, I love, I love the great outdoors, right? You know, we say that, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when we say I love that thing, we're saying I love what I get out of it, the enjoyment, the benefit, the life that it gives me. When Jesus left the glory of heaven for the trouble of earth, when Jesus was subjected to the most excruciating form of execution that humanity could devise, this isn't a complacent kind of love. This isn't something he's enjoying, you know, just getting all kinds of benefit out of. That's a different kind of love. It's what Edwards refers to as benevolent love. With benevolent love, love is driven by the well-being of another person. Love is driven by the well-being of another person. With benevolent love, you see my need and you meet it because there's something inside of you driving, driven just to see my well-being accomplished. That's what Jesus was showing. That's the kind of love he's illustrating as he laid down his life. Jesus saw our need to be forgiven, saw our need to be redeemed, saw our need to be reconciled. And being driven by that need, Jesus laid down his life for us. In fact, if John was going to define love for us, I think he might define it like this. Love is a commitment. It's a commitment to sacrifice what I want in order to make sure you have what you need. Love is a commitment to sacrifice what you want to make sure the person sitting in the pew next to you has what they need. John says, you want to see love? Look at Jesus. Look at his benevolent love. Look at how he laid down his life for us. And then John, he tells us, okay, now this is what Jesus did. This is what we need to do now. In fact, John almost mirrors Jesus' statement. Jesus said to us, you know, a new command I give you, you know, love one another as I have loved you, so you should love one another. John says, hey, this is love. Jesus laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. But then this is where John shifts gears. Again, he started out with this ultimate example of love. This very theological, you know, cerebral idea of what love looks like in the cross. But then when he tells us we should lay down our lives for each other, he gets super nuts and bolts practical. He says, this is what it looks like. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on him, how? How can the love of God be in that person? John's simply saying, look, if you got stuff, if you have material possessions, literally translated, if you have the biology of life, if you have what you need to meet your basic needs for living, food, clothing, shelter, transportation, and you see a brother or sister who doesn't have that, love does something about that. In fact, John kind of states it in the reverse, you know, order. He's like, hey, if you've got the biology of life, you've got what you need, you've got enough, and you see your brother or sister, and they don't have enough, they don't have what they need, like, and you don't do something, You don't feel for them? There's something wrong with that. John's language is actually colorful. Now, when we say colorful, we oftentimes think profane. It's not quite profane, but depending on how proper you are, you might think it's kind of close to that line. But when John says, if you have no pity on them, if you were to translate that literally, you would translate that as if you were to withhold or lock off your bowels from them. Right? He says, hey, you see somebody, they don't have what it takes to get through life. If you could lock off your bowels from them, how could you say the love of God is in you? Does that sound weird to anybody? Yeah, a little bit. All right, here's what's going on with that, right? In the ancient world, they saw the center of emotion or the center of feeling to reside, they believe it resided in your bowels, in your gut. Now, that's not so strange. Just today, we think the center of emotion resides in your heart, right? So we say things like, you know, I love you with all my heart. They would say things like, I love you with all my bowels. Just how it worked, right? Or we would say things like, you know, you have a fight with your spouse. Baby, baby, don't close off your heart to me. They would say, baby, baby, don't close off your bowels to me, all right? We say today, you know, I love you so much it moves my heart. Oh, yeah, yeah. I love you so much it moves my bowels. It's just how it worked, all right? It's just different expression where you think emotion resides, right? John's simply saying, look, you see somebody and they don't have enough to make it in life. If this should strike you, it should stir something at the core of your emotions. He's saying, if I can see somebody who I call my brother and sister in Christ, and they don't have enough, if that doesn't do something to me, there's something seriously out of alignment with God's love in my heart. It's just, he's saying, that's not okay. And then as he wraps it up, John gets really practical about this whole love thing. He gives us one more clarifying point. He tells us that the kind of love that we're supposed to live into with each other, it's an action-oriented kind of love. It's a love that takes action. See, Jesus saw our need, and Jesus took action. He laid down his life. If we're really going to love one another, John's saying, the love we have, it isn't a love that just loves with words and speech. It's a love that loves with actions and truth. See, I can say all day long, I love you, I love you, I love you. But if I don't do something about that, if my love doesn't get fleshed out in some kind of action, according to John, it's void of truth. My love you is a little better than a lie. The kind of love John has in mind here, it's an acting kind of love. It's a love that takes the form of deeds. Deeds. We're talking flesh and blood. Get your tuchus off the couch, drive to the hospital, and go and see them deeds. Put the pan on the stove, take the food out of the fridge, make them a meal, take it to their house, deeds. Get out the checkbook, find out how much the bill is, write it up, mail it in for them, deeds. Go over to the house, tell them to get lost for a while, babysit their kids, deeds. The love that John has in mind, it's deeds. It's action on your part for the benefit of somebody else. And just a clarifying point, John specifically illustrates deeds with money here. It doesn't have to be limited to that. The resources we can spend on behalf of another person, they can be financial. But you can spend your time, you can support that person emotionally, you can support them spiritually and more. All of those things, you're giving your resources away. John simply illustrates it with money in this instance. And I don't know, maybe he illustrates it with money because of all the resources we have, that tends to be the one that we hold on to most tightly and are least likely to give away. But he says, hey, you want to know what love looks like? You want to know what love does? Look at Jesus. Look at Jesus. He benevolently loved us as he laid down his life for us. Now you just do the same thing. And laying down your life, it's not that complicated. You see what somebody needs and you take action. You meet that need for them. Now again, John grew up in the church, was part of that early church. And there were times where John got to see this lived into by the church. The book of Acts records where the church does this poorly, and it records where the church does this well. Here's some of what Acts tells us about this first church John was a part of. It says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. And then here's the part that's relevant to what we've been talking about. It says, all the believers were together and held everything in common. My stuff's your stuff. Your stuff is my stuff. And they sold their property and possessions to give to anyone who had a need. As a result, every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes, and they ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. So you've got this community of people. Some of them have enough. Some don't. And when the folks who had enough or more than enough saw the folks who didn't have enough, they took action. They literally sold their stuff. They sold the house up north. They sold the boat out on the lake. They dipped into their 401k. It was like, hey, I've got more than enough. You don't have enough. You've got a genuine need, not a want, a genuine need. I am committed to sacrificing what I need to sacrifice to make sure that everybody's needs are met here. They lived out this love. When loving the person next to them was going to cost them something, they're willing to pay it. When love came at a price, they didn't shrink back. They didn't bail. You didn't have folks in this church go, well, I didn't sign up for that. They heard Jesus loud and clear. Jesus told them, anyone who wants to be my disciple must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And they watched what Jesus did for them, and they decided, all right, we're going to do this for each other. As a result, it was a different kind of community. They put a higher priority on each other than they did themselves or their money or their stuff. There was a simplicity. There was a simplicity there about what mattered most. There was a clarity in their priorities that was liberating. And there was something there among them that distinguished them from the culture that surrounded them. There was nowhere else in the first century Greco-Roman world where you could find a community like that. The way they loved each other, it made them different. And it's part of what helped them survive. See, we shouldn't be here today. We shouldn't be having this conversation. This building should not exist. The church as a whole should not exist. The church never should have survived the first century. Yeah, they enjoy some initial favor with the culture that surrounds them. You keep reading the book of Acts, that did not last, right? And you study history, like for 300 plus years, the church was up against it. If you understand what the church started with, they never should have got out of the first century. Their founder, Jesus, is subjected to a form of execution that is specifically designed to humiliate him and to get his followers to renounce him and his movement. The leaders of the early church, you know, you got 12 guys who rarely, if ever, understood what Jesus was saying about his mission and his ministry and what he wanted them to do. When Jesus has his greatest hour of need, what do those 12 guys do? Well, they betray him. They deny him. They abandon him. After he dies, they're really brave guys. They all go into hiding. They go underground, right? The early church is born out of Judaism. It's a Judaism that they're surrounded by. It's a Judaism that very quickly identifies them as a monstrous heresy. You got to get rid of this thing. Like, the early church has the Judaism that is surrounding them, imprisoning them, murdering their leaders right, left, and center. And when Christianity spreads to the Roman Empire, and it's not a noble thing. They're fleeing for their lives. It gets too hot in Palestine. They're running for their lives, and they spread out into the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire very quickly identifies Christianity as a threat to their political security, as a threat to their religious purity, as a threat to their cultural values. The Roman Empire, the most powerful government and military known to the world at that time, decides we are going to leverage the full extent of our power and authority to snuff this Christianity thing out. They never should have made it out of the first century. And yet, not only did they survive, but they thrived. And they did so in part because of this kind of love. See, in spite of the fact that the culture around them misunderstood them and misjudged them and misinterpreted them and oftentimes despised them and what they stood for and what they believed, that culture could not deny these people are different. The way they love each other, there's something compelling about this. And so those were being added to the church. The number increased daily. In spite of the fact that Christianity was consistently persecuted, people came to it in droves. And they did so because of love. In fact, the love of the church is what eventually brought the Roman Empire to its knees. But you see, if you understand love, this isn't surprising. Because this is what love does. Love's a commitment to sacrifice what I want in order to make sure that you have what you need. And when people are living like that, when a community lives like that, it's virtually impossible to stand in light of that kind of love for very long and not have it impact you. That's exactly what the early church did. Now, last week I shared that this series is born out of a couple of things. It's born out of an observation on my part for how our church loves well and a desire to call us to live into that better. And it's born out of an observation on my part of where our church doesn't love well and a desire to call us to something higher. The kind of love that we're talking about today, in my experience, from my vantage point, this is one of the ways that faith just excels. Our church loves so well this way. Like, back in July, my brother-in-law had his accident. He's in the hospital. I'm not even on staff here. I don't even work here, right? And my inbox is blowing up with emails. My phone is blowing up with voicemails. People from this church telling me they're praying for me, telling me they're praying for my family, going to the hospital to visit my brother-in-law and his wife and their kids, asking, what can we do to help? I start September 1st, from September all the way through January. Almost every Monday, I'd leave church with multiple meals. Meals that people here at this church made and sent home for me and my family. Meals that were, for me, just huge. Absolutely huge. See, my wife was all kinds of tied up with her sister Sarah and with the kids and the hospital and all the craziness. If not for those meals, my daughter Becca and I, we would not have eaten, all right? We'd have gone hungry or we'd have eaten junk food. It's just, you know, it'd have been bad news. People sent us meals, multiple meals. We ate and we ate good food, right? And then in December when my brother-in-law died, just the outpouring of cards and condolences and compassion. It was overwhelming. Just overwhelming. And then all kinds of people here, all kinds of people here gave gifts to my sister-in-law. Sarah's never so much as stepped foot in this building. You all never met her. And yet you opened your bowels to her, right? Here's a complete stranger, and you guys are giving her money. In an effort to love me and my family well, you are making sure that her and her kids had their needs met. Like, I have been the personal recipient of the kind of love we're talking about here, and our church loves well that way. And what was even more encouraging to me is, like, I watch our church love other people well that way too. See, it's easy, because of my role here, I'm kind of like a high-profile person. It's easy to love me that way well. But when I watched our church love the rank and file well, that was beautiful. I could stand up here and share with you more stories than we've got time for me to tell about how I've watched our church do this. I've got time for one, though. And rather than me telling you, let's watch it on the screens.
It all started after Christmas. He started to feel sick, and we just thought it was the flu, but the pain got tremendous, and we wound up going into the hospital and found out that he has kidney stones. And less than 12 hours later, he woke up in complete rigors.
Waking up with these shakes on the second day was startling. It was completely out of my control.
Not long after that, we found out that he also had an infection in his blood, and they wanted to run a barrage of tests on him. That was a very scary episode. They wound up calling in rapid response team,
which is several people coming to the room.
And as things got worse, they were meeting, you know, the doctors in the hallway, right in front of the door, talking about him. They started hitting him with hardcore antibiotics, and they kept saying he's going to start responding. I thought, well, they were saying within hours we should start seeing an improvement. And so I thought, oh, by the next morning I'm going to come in. He'll be feeling better. And I came in the next morning, and he was worse. That day passed, and I thought, he's going to be sitting up talking to me, smiling. And he didn't.
I became so desperate for air over such a long period of time that it was exhausting. And the way that it unfolded, I did understand at some point that I was close and it was serious.
I felt I had no control over anything. I often sing my prayers, and there was a song that was repeatedly in my head over and over while he was in the hospital, and it's the song, "My Fear Doesn't Stand a Chance When I Stand in Your Love."
There was a time when I became aware enough that this wasn't just hard on me, and that it was hard on Kim and Josh and Jay's, but hard on the family.
I knew I needed somebody by my side, and I sent a text out, and it was literally within minutes that we had people there with us. And then from that point on, nonstop, we had people calling and texting and stopping by.
The church stepped in, and they were there in so many fantastic ways that really made me grateful to be part of this church.
The church ministered not just to my family, our immediate family, but also to my family in Minnesota. I was trying to keep them up to date, and I remember having a conversation with my mom, and she goes, "Well, I can come, and I can just be at the house, and I can take care of the boys, and I can grocery shop and cook cook food for you? And I responded and said, Mom, actually, we're good. I've got our church family here, and they're taking care of those things. So right now, I think we're okay. And my mom, who's not a believer, said, I know you do. I know you do. That's great. She goes, you know, let me know. But it was our church ministering also to my non-believing family in Minnesota, and that was a blessing.
People should be critical of what we believe, but envious of what we have, right? And I think that this was a moment where that was probably true. In that situation, I would be envious of having that much care and that much love poured out on us. It was really very meaningful. Even in the middle of it, it's very meaningful. I'm Brian Bates.
I'm Kim Bates.
And this is our story of faith.
Good job, church. Good job. If see Marcus in here? There he is. Give Marcus a hand. Marcus helped put that video together for us. So this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother and sister in need and has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. See, all day long, we can talk about who we are, we can talk about what we believe, but at the end of the day, our devotion to God, our true identity, those things are going to be illustrated through and they're going to be authenticated by the way we love each other. The way we treat one another, it tells a story about who we are. That's why Jesus told us, by this, everyone will know if you're my disciple, by the way you love each other. Would you stand with me, please? So as we wrap things up today, we're going to receive our offering and close in some worship together. But before we do, I want to give you an opportunity just to respond to God. If the love, the benevolent love of God through Jesus is something you've never said yes to, but you know you need to, before we move on and worship, I want to invite you to do that. It's as simple as a conversation that you can have with God right here, right now. And so you need to say yes. You need to receive that love. I just want to invite you to pray silently with me, and then we're going to continue on in our worship together. Father, thank you so much just for our church and for all the ways that folks seek to love each other well in this. Father, for some of us today, this idea that we were in need of forgiveness, that we were in need of redemption, that we were in need of being reconciled to you. Just as we're hearing this, you're grabbing a hold of our hearts, and we just confess this is true. Father, we just come to you and we confess, I need to be forgiven. I need to be redeemed. I need to be made right with you. Thank you that in response to my brokenness, in love, Jesus Christ laid down his life for me. I just want to surrender all of who I am to him. I want to put all my hope and my trust and my faith in him. I want to begin this journey where I follow him and learn to live and to love like he loved, like he lived. In his name we pray. Amen.